Welcome, everybody. You're listening to Beyond the Matrix, the radio program that dares you, and I mean dares you, to think outside the box of convention. And, you know, man, do we need to get out of that box of conventional thinking and dare to speak out to, well, I guess what the thought police would say, commit thought inappropriate behavior or something, because something's got to give here, and that's what I'm asking you to do. Every time you listen in to Beyond the Matrix. So, first of all, thank you for listening in. As you're obviously aware, if you're listening in now, I've changed from Thursdays to Saturday, and this is for convenience for people who were having trouble listening in on Thursday nights, or nights my time, days your time on the West Coast. So, again, this is Patricia Corey. My website is the www.syrianrevelations.net. Before I tell you about my guest today, I would like to give you some interesting news, and that is that a reminder that my next book is coming out soon, Where Pharaohs Dwell. Please keep your eyes open for it. It's available on pre-sale on Amazon, and I think you're going to love this one. So I'm looking forward to bringing that out to the world and sharing it with all of you. Those of you, so many of you who have that call to Egypt, the call to remember that experience somewhere, somehow on the space-time continuum, you sense that you've lived. That's what the book is about, and I really am excited that it soon will be available for us. Well, my guest is in Israel, so we will bring him on in just a few minutes, because the Sabbath will be ending exactly 5 minutes after the hour. He'll be on. His name is Dr. Gerald Schroeder. He's the author of a book called God According to God. I thought that was a great title and well worth investigating with this doctor of physics who is also a theologian. Sounds very interesting. Analyzing and re-examining what we experience about God, what we perceive God to be, what the Bible has told us God is. It's a daring idea, in my opinion, to write such material. He's written another book called The Science of God. So I'm very interested at this point in our passage through this immense shift that we're all experiencing, to merge science and spirit and to give some basis. In other words, merging what the physicists are discovering about spirit and what the metaphysicians like me are embracing in science. This is part of our shift, the coming together of these formerly rather polar at times belief systems or ways of perceiving life and our universe. And as you know, if you're a listener and a reader, I am dedicated to the process of helping both sides merge into one and coming out with some kind of a holistic idea, meaning whole, not referring to necessarily to well-being, but a realistic, holistic approach to the oneness of all things. It's very exciting that we are finally able to have this information at our fingertips. So we will have him on shortly. Before I have him on, and as we wait for him to become free to come on the air, I also want to tell you that I've got a very important program on next Saturday with Rosalind Peterson, who is an expert informed about another no-no area of conversation. And that is something that is extremely important to me right now, and it should be to every single person on this planet. And that is the well-being of our seas and what the Navy plans to do with the upcoming 5 years, referring to upcoming Navy sonar tests. So I hope you'll listen into that show. Please, please, please tell everyone you know to mark your calendar for that event and listen carefully, because we need to wake up to what's going on for the whales, for the dolphins, for every living creature in the sea, and, of course, for the whole of the planet. Okay, I think I've heard the beep, and that means that we've got Dr. Schroeder on the line. Are you there, Doctor?
I am here.
Hiya, thank you for being with us on the Sabbath. I know this is your holy day, so I'm grateful that you've been able to find time to be with us. You're in Israel. We're calling you in Israel.
Right. I'm in Jerusalem. It just ended. Here in Jerusalem, it's about 5 after 8 or 10 after 8. In the evening.
I didn't realize the Sabbath ended at 8.
Yeah.
Great. Well, thank you for being on Beyond the Matrix. This program is about, I don't care, I don't know if you heard my introduction, but I'm dedicated to getting people to thinking outside the box of convention. And very interested in the merging of science and spirit, and that looks to me like what you're up to, and that is one of the reasons why I was so delighted that you accepted my invitation to come on my show.
It's a privilege, and it's an exciting topic, and it's what I spent a lot of time thinking about, and I'm sure you, many people have also.
Well, yeah, as I tell everybody, it's a great time to be alive when finally science and spirit, maybe, are returning to the merging together after such an age of reason. But nonetheless, finally, the two sides seem to be coalescing into a way that we can understand our role in the universe, much less our existence as individuals. So I'm going to ask you to jump in. First of all, just give us a little bit of a back. You've got an amazing background. You're a theologian and you're also a physicist. That's right.
That's, you said it exactly. Strict personality.
Yeah, that's great. How did you come about, the first book was The Science of God, is that right?
The very first book was Genesis and the Big Bang. The second was The Science of God.
Genesis of the Big Bang, that's a great title.
Genesis
Can you give
the
us
Big
a little
Bang.
Background about what your process and how you came to bring forward such information and knowledge?
I think there's a two-stage process. One, it will sound strange, but I didn't grow up in a city. I grew up in the country. You walk out of the house, of the door, and you didn't see any of the houses. We had an orchard and woods and things like that. And when you're involved in nature, like pruning apple trees, it sounds mundane every winter, but there is something spiritual about it. Working the land has a spiritual aspect to it. We weren't farmers. My father is. But there is a, when you start touching nature, it kind of seeps into you, the idea of this world going forward, not like a cycle, but it's a helix spiraling through time and through space. And so then one thing led to another, and I went to MIT and spent a lot of years there, feeding my, all my degrees, bachelor's, master's, PhD, before I moved to Israel. And in that work, things started to gel. But not totally, until in my graduate school work, I was involved in some work with the strategics arm limitations, and I witnessed the detonations of 6 atomic bombs and managed to live to tell about it, thank God. But after the first event, we called them events in those days, I was asked to give a talk at the Jewish services at MIT. I was in grad school by that time. And I talked about the bomb. In fact, the talk was just before the peak day of the year, and the Hebrew calendar is called Yom Kippur, the Day of Atonement. And I was asked to give a talk. And frankly, it was a good talk because it was all about the bomb, nothing about religion whatsoever. But one year after the other, I started to learn more deeply. And the more you get into the philosophy that lies behind the idea of the spirit that's present in the world, in the biblical text, whatever source of spirituality you're finding, you see that there's something going on in the world that isn't merely what you can put on a scale and weigh or see through a microscope. And when you get into quantum physics, then the integration becomes, it's not just an integration. Physics and science have physics and spirit are now one. It's not as if there's two. You don't, when you read in Physical Review or Review of Scientific Instruments in the physical journals with all the formulas, you don't see it. But when you read the philosophical writings of the leaders in the physics of the small, namely quantum physics or quantum mechanics, these persons, Nobel laureates, wax eloquent on how the entire world is the expression of a mind or of information or an idea. In other words, that at the fundamental level of all existence isn't the material stuff that I'm seeing as I look around the room or if I look out the window. That's what we see because we're in the picture. But we see this material world because our bodies are in the picture. But there's something much deeper that physics talks about. It's not like it's merely theoretical now. We now know that much of the world that we perceive is in fact an illusion. I mean, even on the simplest level of the material world, you look at an atom, A-T-O-M, an atom, the fundamental building blocks of material. And the stone is made up of atoms and it seems solid. And the wood is made up of things, atoms mean solid. But if you look at the dimensions, and my background's in heavy nuclear physics, if you look at the dimensions of an atom, and let's say you scaled it up to a model that you could look at it, and atoms are obviously minuscule. Let's say you made the nucleus, the center of the atom, about the size of an orange or a grapefruit. And then you've got this electron cloud. An atom is made up of a solid nucleus in the center, and then a cloud of electrons around them. So, Patricia, what would you guess? If I made the nucleus, just to make it as a scale, I made the nucleus of an atom, the center of the atom, about the size of an orange or a grapefruit. How far away would the electron cloud be? Any guesses? Patricia?
Oh, boy, you know, I really would love to have the answer for that.
4 miles. It'd be 4 miles away in each direction.
4 miles.
4 miles away in each direction,
wow.
Which and everything between that is nothing. It's not air. Air is a molecule. In other words, what I'm getting at here is even the solid world that we can measure, it's not there.
That's right. And the thing that's really exciting is when you look at a new perception of God, or perhaps it's not that new, but God as the creator mind, one can't help but notice that it seems to be a very mathematically oriented, precision-oriented mind. Not that there's not incredible art involved with the creative mind, but certainly we look at the building blocks of science, and everything is mathematics.
It is, as it's been said very, very famously, God must have been a mathematician.
Well, that's what I always tell everybody in my teaching. When people ask me how do you perceive God, I say the ultimate mathematician, starting with an atom of this and an atom of that and working all the way up to the incredible creations that we are blessed to have before us.
The fact that the world is essentially tuned for life. I mean, when you look at the number of constraints that would be required to make the world work in anything, not just life as we perceive it, any form of complexity. The universe is absolutely tuned for this. Does it mean there's a tuner? It doesn't prove it, but it does seem as if there's some overwhelming, to use the words of Nobel laureate biologist George Wald, there seems to be mind behind the entire system. That the world is the expression of a super intelligence, put it that way, if you want to keep God out of the picture, a super intelligence, kind of using Einstein's words.
And can we also add that if God and this is a great mathematician, he or she surely is also an extraordinary musician, because we know that the balance and the harmonies between notes are, again, ratio, number, it just seems like we're part of just this incredible symphony of mind.
There's a Psalm number 19. It says, "The heavens shout out God's glory, the firmament speaks of God's wonder." And then the next sentence says, "But there's no words, and nothing is heard." Now, the first sentence in the Hebrew are literal speech words. The heavens tell God's glory. Two sentences later, says, "There's no words, and nothing is heard." That there is a symphony in this world. We talk people language. I don't want to sound too kooky, but the fact is, there's a reality in the world that just bubbles to the surface as you get it deeper into the mathematics, the science, and the quantum nature of the world. That everything, in fact, sings the praises of the superintelligence that made the world. I'll call it God, but God's taken a lot of bad raps in the world, so just say the superintelligence.
It did get a bad rap, didn't it? Well, first of all, I'd like to, before you go on with that thought, I'd like you to tell you that you definitely don't seem kooky to me. In fact, it's refreshing to be able to bring people like you on my program and to present people with alternatives to this dogmatic idea that inevitably reverts to some kind of a punishing, justice-seeking figure that has nothing to do, in my humble opinion, with the splendor of what creation is all about.
For that purpose, I wrote my fourth book, God According to God. The idea that this is harsh, you must just be repeating your words. First of all, it's completely false if you read the Bible below any superficial reading of the text. The reality is, even a human body, you have in your body approximately, and I have, every human has approximately 70 trillion, that's 12 zeros, 70 trillion cells, and they work in harmony. The world is magnificent, is a huge word, is a symphony. The heavens do speak of God's glory, and so does the working of a body and everything, even the working of a molecule. The beautiful precision of how the world is put together just speaks of a intelligence that is not a mean, punishing, deliberately demanding, cruel creator. It so patently contradicts what everything you see about how the world is put together. If you take a superficial reading of the world, you could say, well, so if God is so great, why are there hospitals full of cancer? If God is so great, why are there earthquakes crushing the people? And I just want to bring a quick passage, not reading, but just from memory, that I haven't got according to God. I worked a lot in China. By a bizarre nuance, I was the first, Homer Brook of Illinois, and I was the first two foreign advisors brought into China after the Cultural Revolution in 1981, when the Cultural Revolution ended, they need people. No one knew the type of work that we were doing. And so I still have a lot of contacts there. So 2 years ago, there was this horrendous earthquake that killed about 200 students in a school that collapsed.
Mm-hmm.
In the photograph of the school, less than 2 yards away, the width of a person holding out their arms, there was a school for the rich kids in town. Not a crack in the building. The school that collapses is the poor kids in town. In the background of the picture, an 8-story hotel, completely fine. This school collapsed. And in the article that was sent to me from a colleague of mine, Frank Nwanga in Hong Kong, the article quotes the father of one of the 200 children who had been crushed, and he's looking at the bodies of these children lying there, crushed. And he said the following: this is not a natural disaster. This is a man-made disaster. The other buildings didn't collapse. The evil people, I'd use more, if it weren't the radio, I'd use more of all the language. The evil people that built that school used sand instead of cement in the support columns. So the school collapsed. We can make the world earthquake-proof. Earthquakes are part of how the universe is put together. If we want an Earth that's habitable, we're going to have earthquakes, because earthquakes are the result of the magma moving, which is the result of which produced the magnetic field, which allowed life to appear on Earth. So we can make the world earthquake-proof, but we haven't. Those people, to save a few yuan, or whatever the Chinese currency was then, built their school out of sand instead of cement. It wasn't
right, but the person who's listening to you now, and I only play the devil's advocate here, for lack of a better term, will say, well, then why did God, I don't like this word God so much, so let's say, why did Prime Creator create man to be so flawed? I mean, this is the existential question that keeps coming around and around and around. And,
well,
I mean, the evil and good paradigm aside for a moment, why does a all-loving creator, God, prime creator, create man or human with such terrible flaws, to be honest? I mean, we're supposed to be the most intelligent species on the planet, and quite honestly, I don't see a lot of intelligence in a lot of human behavior.
I think a better way of saying it, man has the potential to be flawed, or the potential to be great. We've cured a lot of cancer in this world. We build buildings that stand up against earthquakes. But we also have greed within us. And God allows God, I use the word creator, the creator of the universe, has given a level of free will across the board in everything, including the laws of nature have this uncertainty principle. But we also have choice and free will. I don't think it's that we're flawed. It's that we have the ability to act in a way that is either for our benefit or for our lack of benefit. And I think the world is pretty magnificent. The reason that we see the flaws, I think, is that because the world is so great that every bad nuance stands out like a sore thumb, like a flag. But in reality, most people go to work and are decent human beings. There are some creeps in the world that build buildings out of sand.
I like that. There are some creeps. Actually, there are quite a number of creeps at very high levels of management of the planet. What do you have to say to that?
I wish I had an answer. I tell you, we see it everywhere. The answer is...
It's a tough thing, isn't it? I mean, you know, we really do... Obviously, there's a constant battle to establish some kind of balance between the poles that seem to define the duality of our dimension, at least, our planet, our dimension, who knows. And this perennial battle we define as the good between between good and evil. But the truth is, it just seems like the guys that are running the strings here are in many ways intent on destruction.
The example that I use consistently is we're busy finding water on Mars when people are dying of dehydration in Sahara. Who cares if there's water on Mars? You submit billions of dollars to make the water purification in the Sahara. I agree with you. The fact.
Well, there are some people, I'm one of them, who believe that in their madness, like the mad scientists, some of the guys that really run this planet are intent on diminishing the population because in their blindness, they believe that that's what will save the planet because we're just overpopulated to the point of the breaking point. Do you agree with that idea?
No, I don't. I would say, first of all, the planet can support a lot more people than we're doing if we use our resources correctly. But I would rather not believe, although there's an excellent book written, a novel, the title just fits my mind about scientists trying to control population by introducing some horrible diseases or whatever. I don't think that the people run the planet because the way that they feel that the universe is, or the Earth has become overpopulated. I think what's happening is simply that greed, political interests and greed are a reality in human
nature. Greed is the big one, isn't it?
Greed is the big one. In this week's portion and next week's portion of the Bible that we're reading, it talks about it to have a king. And it's in the book of Deuteronomy, the fifth book of the Bible. And in Deuteronomy, the king, which would be any ruler, is limited onto how much wealth he can accumulate. And there are limits. It is true that power corrupts, infinite power is infinitely corruptible. But there are, in fact, possibilities to control that. You don't have to get into the desire. But everyone wants great things for their neighbors as long as they've got a little bit more than their neighbors. That's the way the world is. That's what we aim for. More philosophical.
I hope you're not right about that, but we look around and we see that in most of the cases in the world, at least in the developed world, that is the reality. On the other hand, I'm sure you'll agree that the collapsing of these systems of the financial systems in the world are creating opportunities for us to revert back to the kind of humanity that we're capable of, the kind of community consciousness that we are capable of.
The tremendous financial disaster is a pretty much a big wake-up call to get the world back online. The biblical God is the God is defined in the Bible in a pivotal statement in Exodus chapter 3, verse 14, second book of the Bible. He says, Yeah, I will be that which I will be. The world is a certain way. If we may want a different type of creator, I'll put it this way. We may be a different type of creator. We may have some fantasy, but there's only one great game in town. That's the world we live in. We have to make it better. We have to be partners. But how this creator of the world, if the biblical text is a valid description of how the creator of the world put the world together, then that pivotal statement in Exodus, I will be, it's not I am that I am, it's I will be that which I will be. God is essentially saying, I'll run the world the way I run it, but it's up to you to make it better. It is up to we as persons with this tremendous skill that we've been given to perfect the world. That's our obligation, which is phenomenally empowering because it means that we're part of the creation system. We were present at the creation. I mean, you can take the biggest skeptic in the world, the atheist, agnostic, just skeptic, whatever, and that skeptic, he or she still believes that the Big Bang, the creation of the universe, produced a burst of energy, and that's all that it produced. The beginning of time as we know it, a burst of energy, super powerful light beams, for a simplistic way of describing energy, super powerful light beams. And those light beams are the only physical creation. Physics is unequivocal about this. It was one physical creation. You, Patricia, and I, and everything you're looking around, entered the universe 15 or 14 billion years ago as a burst of energy. It's not that we witnessed the creation. We were part of it. We were the light beams of creation. It sounds as bizarre as it can be. But
no, it doesn't sound bizarre. It sounds magnificent, Dr. Schroeder.
Well, those light beams became alive. If we want to see the beneficiation of the creation and the creator, the Big Bang started with light beams. That's a given. Everyone accepts it. That's the standard model of the creation. Energy comes in many forms, but light beams are the easiest to put your mind around. Electromagnetic radiation. Those light beams, whether it took 15 billion years, 6 days, a microsecond, or eternity, light beams became alive. That's a given. You can speak to Steven Weinberg, Nobel laureate, magnificent human being, avid atheist, and he will also accept the fact that light beams became alive. That's a gift. Pardon me for getting worked up over this, but it's extraordinary. Why does the light beam have the chutzpah, the brazenness, to feel love? Where does a light beam feel love? Do you want to see the beneficent aspect of the creator, the superintelligence? Intrinsic in light beams, which became human beings, that's a given, is the ability to love, to feel emotion, to be self-aware. What a gift in the light, in the world? Love is the most major gift, and every human being has that ability. And it's built into the universe from the very beginning because there was only one beginning, and that beginning is from which that beginning everything is made, which is when you think about it, you step back from the daily car problems of how you're going to pay the grocer at the end of the month or what, you know, getting to make the bus or what, you know, et cetera. And you step back and look at this big picture. We see this ball of rock, the earth in space. I mean, I close my eyes and I see this globe, this huge earth in this magnificent, vast universe. And you go back in time, and the Earth wasn't 4.5 billion years ago. We were stardust. You and I and the table you're sitting by or the computer, whatever you're looking at, were stardust. And 5 billion years ago by that, we were a star that exploded. You and I were part of a star. I mean, when you visualize this, and then further earlier, we were the light beings of creation. We went through that genesis of the universe, you and I and everything around you. Energy became light beams, became hydrogen, helium, became stars. Stars exploded, supernova, stardust. 5 billion years ago, we were stardust, and we were stardust at least twice over because our sun cannot be a first-generation star. There's too much of the heavier elements in it. One of the beauties of science, of understanding just simply why the sky is blue, doesn't take away from the fact the magnificent sight of a sunrise and the sky painting itself blue. Knowing the science behind it doesn't make it trivial. It makes it even more wonderful, more fantastic. And knowing that we were part of that creation, we've been in this universe 15 billion years. And because you and I are talking, even though we're separated by about 10,000 miles at the moment, you're in California, I believe. Is that correct?
No, I'm in Italy, so we're closer.
Oh, you're in Italy. Oh, so
yeah, we have a teleconference.
gizmo going on here. So.
Okay, you're right around the corner. So,
yep.
I mean, we have this, you know, we've been in this universe since its beginning.
That is the most eloquent and beautiful way of expressing our role as co-creators of the universe that I've heard. And it touches me deeply. It's so inspiring to talk with people who can help people understand that everything that exists always has been. We're all part of it. We co-create it. We move in and out through the dimensions. It's all part of the incredible wonder of existence. And it definitely is just a touch different than the God that we have been given by doctrine and religious misinterpretations.
Yeah. Religion has messed up theology. I put it that way. Religions have unfortunately can be used to make, look, Weinberg, Nobel laureate Steve Weinberg said it, that religion can make good people do terrible things and to have in the past. You know, it's a terrible thing.
And still do. I mean, let's face it, religion has, if you look at the, well, I'm not here to knock religion because I don't want to alienate anyone, but the truth is that one of the most important things that we will ever understand or search for in our passing through this lifetime is an understanding of God and an understanding of our death.
And
through religion, we get some pretty rigid ideas on these, on both of these, which are not always very enlightening.
No, but religion can be a source of tremendous good and of organization, like just like human free will can be good or bad. I think religion can be do exactly the same. But I think the free will is essential, and I think having basic laws and the basic theological concept in the world is essential. We need free will. Without it, we'd be robots, puppets. But we have the free will that gives us a choice to how we live our life, and we can choose it to help humanity or to hurt humanity. And the same thing would be the idea of the religion as well. You can use it for good or for bad. Religion also, like God, has taken a bad rap. It's done a lot of good things in the world as well. It's not. I mean, I'm an Orthodox Jew, so it's pretty much my position is pretty clear in the world. But I don't deny the fact that it was an Orthodox Jew that murdered our prime minister. If you talk about the desecration of what we call desecration of God, you know, and I think it was an Orthodox who killed Gandhi, a Hindu, or in other words, there are always people that are extreme. That's from the shortcomings, but it's like earthquakes. The fact is, the universe has a simple way, a way that's put together. In that way, we've been given freedom, and nature has been given freedom also. It's interesting that the biblical understanding in the Hebrew Bible is that there's a slack in the system, a leeway in the system of how God controls everything, including molecules, including humans. Everything has an aspect of mind within it. Freeman Dyson at the Institute of Advanced Studies at Princeton, I mean, I use names, but anybody that works in quantum physics knows this also, but I want to give credentials to behind this, says that there's an aspect of mind in every atom. Atoms make unpredictable choices as guided by the laws of quantum physics. That mind might be present in the universe from the beginning, as George Wald, Nobel laureate Wald, pointed out so eloquently, in the biologist, the late George Wald, that mind is the essence of existence. It's mind that has given rise to the physical world. And interestingly, although it's hard to accept, to believe it just simply, most people misunderstand the opening words of Genesis, the Hebrew Bible. It's usually like, in the beginning God created the heavens, the earth, there was a beginning. The word beginning was never present. That's the result of a translation from 2,200 years ago into Greek. The opening sentence of the Bible in English, as per the Hebrew, is, "With wisdom, God created the heavens and the earth." That, not that God was wise, but that the substrate of all existence is wisdom. Like, we see the substrate of all physical existence is energy. That's bizarre, but we were discussing that a few moments ago, but that's a given. But suddenly, to try to understand how light beams could evolve, develop, to become loving human beings, there must be something earlier than that. And the
right.
Bible mentions it. Wisdom is the substrate. It is present in every aspect of existence. Mind is... It's so extraordinary when you touch this sudden realization. It's like you get this flush through your body, these goose pimples or whatever. Sometimes I don't touch
yes.
about this. My kids are present.
Because inevitably, if you, as far as you can go into any kind of linear idea of what came first, there, of course, eventually we arrive at the idea that nothing came first. All exist simultaneously. Yet in this 3D reality, we try to pinpoint it, and it just has to be thought.
Thought.
Before energy, before action,
yep.
before waves, the thought, create wisdom, like you say. If
and
you
that's
could imagine
the book of John,
anything.
Right. Yeah, the idea, it's all the same. These, when you look at the sources of most of the philosophies, you'll see that there's this overwhelming awareness of a presence in the world, a presence of a superintelligence, put it that way, superintelligence. I would say that the biggest example of there being a superintelligence or a creator is the creation itself. I think, Patrice, we just take for granted that there's existence. But why should there be existence? Why should there be existence? Anything. Forget life. Just anything. Why is there something? The question is always, why is there something rather than nothing? Marshall McLuhan, I think it was in a book called The Medium is the Massage. I think so. It's his second book, third book. He said, I'm not sure who discovered water, but I'm pretty sure it wasn't the fish. Why? Because the fish are living.
All right, listen, let's take just a quick moment here for those of you who just, I like that quote. If you just tuned in, I have brilliant Dr. Gerald Schroeder here. He's a physicist and a theologian, and he's written a number of really powerful books. His latest is God According to God, A Physicist Proves We've Been Wrong About God All Along. What is your website, Dr. Schroeder? Do you have a place where people can investigate you further?
Yeah, and there's a bunch of essays there also, which may sound cool.
You want to give those out to us on the air?
It's GeraldSchroeder.com.
That's the easy one.
.com, GeraldSchroeder.com.
Okay, GeraldSchroeder.com. So if you've just tuned in, we're talking about the wonder of understanding that according to Dr. Schroeder, and you know my position, we're talking about the great, the prime creator, the overriding wisdom, the magnificence of creation as the supreme intelligence, and perhaps what we've been taught is pretty limiting as far as what a god would be. You know, Dr. Schroeder, in your book you talk about God's ability to, I think you call the chapter a repentant God, how to understand a God that has regrets. Can you talk about this idea a little bit, because I find it very, really fascinating.
Yeah, our picture of God that we imbibe when we're young is this essentially a father figure, a mother figure, all perfect, always giving us answers. We needed something, we cried, we were taken care of, et cetera. God, we have hopefully decent parents. So that carries on into the idea of the picture of God as well, that God's always there, never erring, always on top of everything, and nothing. Yet you look around the world and you see that it's not quite that way. The idea that God might not, the way I see it is that God is learning to run the universe. That's really what I think is happening. It sounds strange, but if you take the description of God according to the Bible, and that's why I call it God according to God, meaning according to God in the Bible. God creates a world. Things go wrong. Adam, the first human, it's very clear, there's a few chapters in other books. Adam and Eve were never considered to be the first Homo sapiens sapiens. They were the first Homo sapiens sapiens with a soul of a humanity. they were Homo sapiens. All the ancient commentaries talk about these other beings that were completely human, except for the spirituality. Anyway, Adam and Eve get this is called the neshama in Hebrew. This name is the neshama, the soul.
Can you repeat that a little bit more slowly, because you're fading out here?
Oh, I'm sorry. Okay. So Adam and Eve, God creates the world. Adam and Eve, the first beings with this human soul, rebel immediately. They eat the forbidden fruit. They're kicked out of the Garden of Eden. Then they have two children. Cain, one child, murders another, fratricide right at the very beginning. And if you think about this, it's pretty extraordinary, Patricia. If you want an example of bad parenting, here it is. Adam and Eve have two kids. Cain is the older. Abel is the younger. Cain decides he wants to bring an offering. The first religious act brought down in the Bible, in the book of Genesis, God brings Cain, the older son, brings an offering to God. Abel, the younger son, thinks that's a good idea. He brings an offering to God. Here comes the bad parenting by God. God rejects Cain's offer and accepts his brother's, Abel's, offer. I mean, you want a lesson on how to have sibling rivalry? There it is. God didn't realize it was going to be a problem. I know it sounds very heretical, but this is the text. Two sentences later, after God has rejected Cain's offering, what does Cain do? He murders Abel. It's so, the outcome is so clear. That's by chapter 4. By chapter 4 of the Bible, the good guy's dead. God accepted Abel's offering. God rejected Cain's offering. That's four chapters out of 187 chapters in the five books of Moses. The good guy is dead. The Torah, the Bible, lays it on the line. In this world, according to the biblical God, and according to the way the world works, bad things do happen. If we want to make it better, we can. By chapter 6, just before the biblical flood, and even if you think the flood never happened, because it would be a metaphor, whatever you want, it's in the text to teach how God runs the world. In chapter 6 of the Bible, the seventh sentence, chapter 6, verse 7, God says, I regret, the Hebrew is nachamti, I regret having made the world. The biblical God, according to the biblical description of God, which is the only description we've got going, besides how the world works in nature, the biblical God has regrets. And that's just a reality in the world. We can see that type of phenomena happens in the world. I mean, if this positive God of the world, the super intelligence of the world, would look out on the world and would see us doing things, the image that I have that are so ridiculous, the image that I have of God sometimes, he's sitting on a chair, I mean, it's totally imaginary, with his head between his knees and saying, oh, what a mess I got myself into here.
This would be one of those occasions to really say, oy vey, right?
Yeah, well, that's exactly the idea. that's what I usually would say. Oy vey, what did I do,
But we have to bear in mind, of course, that the Bible was written by men. So, I do agree with you when you say, or God as you perceive it in nature. And there, it doesn't look like there are any regrets, because everything is so precise. Everything is so perfect in nature.
But hurricanes happen.
Right, but even hurricanes are the reason why hurricanes are so devastating is because we've overpopulated the planet. But the hurricanes are of themselves a natural process which just moves the Earth's energy around. Right?
True. It's like the earthquakes as well.
I mean, let's put it this way. Hurricanes are inconvenient to human beings and other living things, but it is the natural process of life to die. Death is a natural process. We don't like it because we don't want to leave, so we, first of all, would build our communities out into the most unthinkable areas. Hurricanes come and we blame God for destroying our lives. But the truth is, the planet is a living being and it needs earthquakes and hurricanes to reassess her energies. You with me?
True. Yes.
So, it's like man always cursing God for all of the terrible things that happen, but they're not really terrible on the planetary scale. They're natural.
And that's right, the point I'm trying to make also with earthquakes. They are natural, they're part of the system, and we're going to have them. But we have
one of the problems here is man's desire to dominate and control nature. And in essence, we're talking about
I mean, I might be out on a limb here, but it's as if God, as if man wants to dominate God.
Say that again, this man what?
What I'm saying is, we blame God for the earthquakes, and we curse God sometimes for the earthquakes and for the horrendous things that happen, and yet they are nature. So in cursing God, aren't we demonstrating that we're trying to control God? God's manifestation or creation's manifestation of natural phenomenon are part of that consciousness.
Am I making sense? I absolutely agree.
I'm the one with the goose pimples.
The fact is, the world is not, by our perception, the world is not a perfect world. And as you say, death is reality. I think that may be one of the things that makes humans different from other animals, is that I think we perceive, we can have this understanding or lack of, we can understand our lack of understanding of what death is really about.
I think that one of the most important searches of the human mind, more than trying to understand God, is trying to understand our mortality, our immortality and our mortality. This seems to torture the human mind more than any other concept. And yet, aside from the Tibetans, we spend very little time thinking about what comes beyond the physical reality.
Yeah, but, well, except science has touched on it now. I mean, science, of course, I have a vested interest in saying this, being a scientist, who also spends time studying biblical sources. The physics implies, as I said before, that the physical world is more a perception than a reality. That mind or information, I'm not quoting the Bible, I'm quoting science, this published scientific literature, that mind, the words used are mind, information, idea, are actually the basis of reality. And if that's the case, Patricia, then the way that I think about death is that death marks the end of our body's participation in life, but life continues. I think that death marks the end of our body's participation in life. There's a book I wrote, Life After Life. What life would be without a body, I don't have any understanding. Is it possible that near-death experiences are real, or are they only projections of what we'd like to believe?
What about reincarnation?
Beg your pardon?
What about reincarnation?
Yeah, well, I think near death experiences. I don't know what your total your theological or let's say super intelligence philosophy is, or take understanding of the world is, but I would say from having studied some cases of near death experiences, having interviewed persons that have had them, but more than that, the journal Lancet, which is one of England's leading medical journals, if not England's leading journal of medicine, about 5 to 6 years ago, had an article on a study of near-death experiences in which they studied, I think the number was 343 persons that had these cases. And their conclusion was, which passed peer review, is that transcendence should be considered as a possibility of the explanation of these experiences. Transcendence means, of course, something non-physical that continues. And these people were clinically dead. And, they were welcomed by their deceased relatives. I mean, we all know the stories of them, but the fact that it could make it into a peer-reviewed journal, I think is significant. If it's just not anecdotal, if there is really a substance in near-death experience, then this would be a spirituality that continues beyond the end of the physical world that we perceive. Erwin Schrödinger, the physicist, wrote something very interesting. He said that the physical world that we perceive is more a perception than a reality. And the reason that we think the physical world is the reality is that our bodies are in the picture, and this is our only way of communicating. That's an exact quote. Our bodies are in this physical picture, and that is our only way of communicating with them. What's the hour? Who's the hour? The hour is the real essence. The real essence is the fact that as we, and the simple example that I see is, I talk to you, and you talk to me, and people, we hear others talking in the background. There's no sound in your brain. There is zero sound in your brain other than gurgle, gurgle as the blood goes through the veins. But you're hearing sound. So the sophisticated would say, well, that's how we understand the chemical reactions. We know that the chemical reactions in the brain. But chemical reactions aren't sound. Where do you perceive the sound? Is the mind really where we perceive the sound? And the mind interacts with the brain, kind of like a radio and the radio waves. The radio waves are out there. You turn the radio on, you hear the music. You turn the radio off, you don't hear the music. You smash the radio waves aren't affected. Is the brain, the physical brain, the blood, the flesh and blood of within the head, the brain, this magnificent structure, is that like the system that picks up the information of the mind? That the mind is out there, and out, each person's brain is tuned into the mind that is really what the person is.
Isn't your description earlier about the explosion of light is the universal mind? And isn't it interesting to consider that there is one mind, and that we may be sparks or somehow sparks of that light, sparks of that one mind consciousness, so that we experience some sense of individualism, but in the end, it is one mind.
That's beautiful what you're saying, and it's extraordinary, it's almost scary, because about 1931, that was making about 78 years ago, Sir James Jeans wrote a book called The Mysterious Universe, and he suggested exactly that. That was the very beginning of quantum physics, when we were just beginning to understand the essence. Now it's much more clear that I think you may have touched on the ultimate reality, that we are like appendages out of this one mind. And I think that may be when we tap into that, the more general mind, I think that's the extraordinary experience that we get. I mean, sometimes you see a magnificent sunrise or a piece of music or a loved one, and you feel this flush go through your whole body. I think that's when you're touching that universal mind in which we are embedded, in which the whole universe is embedded.
Supraluminescence.
I said it's something that
I could describe as supraluminescence.
Superluminescence. Interesting. I don't know how to erase it, but if you read Proverb number 8 in any English or the Hebrew, Proverb number 8 defines the world as the expression of wisdom, and says that wisdom was the first creation. Now, the Proverbs were written, they certainly weren't written before the time of, it's about 2,500 years ago, and now we have quantum physics coming with the same statement. In Proverbs 8, it says wisdom was the basis of all creation. And it's not saying that God was wise, it's saying that there's a substrate to this world, and then that explains everything. It explains how the world could develop in its way. Every example, I don't sound like pontificating, so I apologize. But there are some things that we see explicitly in nature. And one is the origin of information. There is no example in the entire physical world in which information is present. I mean ordered complexity, okay? Ordered complexity, information. There is no example in the world in which information exists in which there was not a substrate before that in which information was put in place. A computer program. We know that computer programs can go and become more clever and more clever. They can learn. But there's always that first program. If you don't have the first program, there was that piece of information in the beginning, you get nothing but nothing. You get absolutely nothing. And every example that we have of ordered complexity always has as a structure, even if it's more simple, but still an input of information.
Now we're always perennially seeking that first information. This is driving us out of our minds. And all we can end up with is the wisdom that you have discussed today, as a prime creator. To me, the great mathematician, the great creator, the great wisdom behind all existence, but there's always that question of what was the first? And we're probably never going to be able to answer that other than to embrace the idea that there just may very well be no first. It's all cohesive, coexisting. We want that first because we exist in a linear dimension where we have this false sense of linear time, but we're learning through great teachers like you that perhaps the quantum physicists have got it down to just understanding that it all coexists. And that's what the spiritualists have been saying throughout the millennium.
Absolutely. Absolutely. You know, it's absolutely the case. Finally, what was a lovely statement that the scientist climbs higher and higher up the mountain of knowledge. Who was the person that said, and higher and higher, and he finally pulls himself over the final rock, and he reaches the summit, and there he finds theologians that have been sitting there for centuries.
I love it. Dr. Schroeder, our time is just about up, but before we finish, I would like to leave. Well, I've got a quick, you're going to have to answer this quickly. We're at that 2012 timeline, and people say the Bible prophecies. Well, this is not a simple question, I know, but anyway, the Bible says we're up against Armageddon. I personally am a person that believes we are entering into a time of great enlightenment for humanity. And can you give us just a really brief answer as to how you perceive this passage?
Well, I don't know if it's going to be 2012 or exactly what it will be, but it seems that suddenly with this information explosion, that for the first time, you can be in Italy. People are living, maybe listening, whoever they are. I got a letter, an email the other day from the South Pole. Thank you for some things I've said. In other words, I think the fact that we have this sudden integration in which humanity finally has the option, the opportunity of becoming one, it doesn't mean we all have to be the same. We don't have to all be the same. Diversity is important. Nature's proven that. For survival, you want diversity. But diversity that works as a friendly as opposed to an antagonistic community. You want diversity. If you want, one is the baker, one is the shoemaker, and suddenly we have this idea of a global village of being bad. It actually could be wonderful. No one group has to give up its way of life, but when it becomes integrated, and I think this is what we're heading towards now, just talking about what you're saying, that suddenly everyone in the world has access to this information instantaneously.
It's so true. That's really a very keen observation, that with all the downfalls and negativities of our technology, that oneness that we speak of it on a very lofty way is technologically becoming more and more available to us. So perhaps you're right. Perhaps this is one of the great aspects of our passing through this time of definite change and shifting. And, boy, I'm ready for it. Bring it on, as I say.
Yeah.
Well, Dr. Schroeder, I hate to say goodbye because I have been just enthralled talking to you, and I hope that it's not the only time I'll be able to have you on the show, and geez, I'd just love to meet you. So let me know your whereabouts, please, so I can come and find you in person.
Well, you've got my phone number, I hope. I say it's here, so you come, you join us for a Friday night meal, and we'll have a wonderful discussion for hours on end. I say it's here.
Oh, that is an offer I probably can't refuse. So you will hear from me.
On the website. My phone number is on the website, I think. I think it is.
Oh, that's fabulous. Thank you. All right. We've been talking to Dr. Schroeder.
Where in Italy are you, Patricia?
Yeah?
Where in Italy are you?
I'm in Rome. Are you coming my way?
Oh, you're in Rome. Well, Barbara and I, this is the first year we haven't been to Rome. Look, life in Israel has a lot of pressure. We used to go to Italy for like 2 weeks as a test, almost always test either for Rome or Milano before we go and rent in a house by the water somewhere. So,
well, you come my way, and the dinner invitation stands on this end.
Okay.
I'm sure you're such a kindred soul. I feel great warmth and compassion from you, and it'll be a great honor to spend time with you.
Well,
so let's make that happen,
totally
okay?
Thank you for the opportunity.
All right, everybody. We had the honor of talking to Dr. Gerald Schroeder. His book is amazing. God, According to God, a Physicist Proves We've Been Wrong About God All Along. You've heard him speak in just truly magnificent ways about our existence as co-creators of this fantastic universe. Never lose sight of the beauty of just being. And with that, I have to say goodbye for today, although I'd love to talk to him and to you. But we're going to have to sign out. So don't forget to listen in next week when I'm going to delve into Navy sonar. I care about these whales and dolphins. It is just something I can't let go of, and we've got to care and get involved. So please stay tuned next week. And for now, goodbye to Dr. Gerald Schroeder, great humanitarian and wisdom holder. And goodbye to all of you. Thank you for thinking outside the box of convention and daring to use those exquisite minds and hearts to make the world a better place. Arrivederci, everyone. This is Patricia Corey, www.syrianrevelations.net, signing out. Until next week.